Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Well, this is episode 103. I can still hardly believe that this show has done 103 episodes. Anyway, so let's see. We made some progress on a few secret projects over at the Midnight Freemasons. Details coming soon. There are actually three really cool things, but I'm going to stop there. You all can speculate. I'm looking to change our cover photo on Facebook. I do all right with designs and art, but I'm curious to see what would happen if I opened it up to fan art. So from this day to, I think, the 5th of August, I'm having a Facebook contest for a cover photo that will be up for a year. Entries can be emailed to me here at wcypodcast@gmail.com, or you can post them right up on the Facebook page. Once I get some finalists, we can vote. The winning one will be chosen, and it will go up for 1 year, assuming we actually get some entries. If you're the winner, we can give you a shout-out on the show, and I'll mail you something cool. Some of you no doubt saw a post that I shared about my straight razors. And you know, I wasn't always so keen on them, but a brother who has done wonders for the art of shaving and perpetuating its ideals is still around. He started the Straight Razor Place, a forum dedicated to wet shaving. He started Straight Razor Designs, and has taught a ton of men how to use a straight razor on his YouTube channel. You may be familiar. I'm talking about Brother Lynn Abrams, and I'll be doing a piece on him for the Midnight Freemason soon, and I have also been in touch with him as well, and he's agreed to be a guest on this show, so I'm pretty excited about that. Speaking of guests on a show, I'll be on the Far From Centered podcast here very shortly. The next episode is going to be called The Manterview. It's basically Rob Lewis, myself, and a bunch of other guys just talking. It's sure to be funny, and I'm sure you guys will all love it. Then there will be another episode with Rob Lewis and myself, and there may be another guest or two, and that's going to be a pretty esoteric episode. So I'll keep you all informed on that, and links to those episodes when they get published will go on the blog as well. So, let's dive right into some good Masonic writing. The Antiquity of Geometry. In speculating about symbols, especially Masonic symbols, we are naturally led to think of geometric figures. Mindful of the frequently asserted claim that modern speculative Freemasonry is the inheritor of the, quote, secret tradition, or learning of the ancient priesthoods who thereby exercised the decisive power of the knowledge over their rulers and kings, we assume that these symbols were created or discovered by the learned men of the priestly class. While that is undoubtedly true of many of the more complex and theoretical figures developed by ancient geometricians, a little more speculation should lead us to the realization that the most ancient, the most primitive geometrical symbols used by Homo sapiens were discovered and developed by ordinary men for very practical reasons. Without knowing it, the earliest scientific investigators were the original speculative masons who curiously traced nature to their innermost recesses, and thereby initiated the art of geometry, the one most revered by Freemasons. Primitive man had to climb from a rude state of brutish survival on an individual basis to a simple state of social organization like a group or of families or clan, which could specialize to some extent by developing the practical arts of agriculture, the hunt for meat, storing surplus, etc., before he could allow the weak or the elderly to survive. It was probably such individuals who first had leisure to investigate, to speculate in the simplest possible form of that activity. But when their efforts gave them knowledge by which they were able to advise and direct the activities of the tribe, they realized its power and kept it secret to preserve their status and influence. It was passed on to disciples who were sworn to secrecy. The secret tradition was originally a practical necessity for self-preservation. Such a development probably occurred many centuries ago, long before the ancient civilizations of which we have any historical records, nor did it come about quickly in three or four generations. It must have taken millennia of puzzled observation and the slow accumulation of simple facts to arrive at even the crudest kind of symbol which encompassed more than an observation of shape or direction. The sun and the moon have always been the foremost luminaries of nature influencing the lives of men on this planet. Both are round or circular in shape. Even the most untutored savage probably recognized a crudely drawn circle in the sand as a pictograph of those heavenly bodies. But since the moon changed its shape regularly each month, it could be differentiated from the sun by representing it as a crescent, a shape in which it appeared much more frequently than it did as a circle. The circle, therefore, became a universal symbol of the sun, because it was always round when it could be observed, and because it was obviously the one great heavenly body which brought life-giving light and warmth for the growing seasons. It became the first great object of wonder, cosmic fear, and adoration. In other words, it was man's first god. And the symbol of the sun, the circle, became the first representation to denote the divinity that shapes our ends. But when an organization of human societies, even in their simplest state, made possible the survival of some of the physically weaker and elderly members of such groups, a, quote, leisure class came into existence, which had time to observe natural phenomena more closely, to investigate the immutable laws of nature, to speculate. One of the earliest observed phenomena of the sun was probably its gradual change of position on the horizon at its rising and its setting. But not until the change of position was studied and noted with something akin to exactness, the scientific method, did primitive man derive some useful knowledge from his observations. Among the oldest relics of man's initial science, the observation of the sun and are crude markings on stone which depict the arc of a circle formed by points of the rising or setting of the sun between the summer and winter solstices. Such an ancient monument as that at Stonehenge, England, is highly refined and sophisticated representation of such solar observations. It's comparatively modern. While it must have taken long periods of time to develop such a simple representation of the sun's journey from season to season, try to imagine the superstitious awe and wonder of the primitive sun-gazers when they began to realize that the circular sun was drawing a great circular arc on the Earth's surface, that the great sun god was recreating his shape right before them. And when they had amassed enough information to realize that the sun, in its rising and setting, always turned in the other direction at a definite time, repeated annually, they not only had knowledge which determined a beginning and end for certain seasons, they had unlocked a secret of nature which gave them power to advise and to regulate the lives of their neighbors and their tribesmen. They had learned the hard way that knowledge is power, and to preserve that power they made it a secret among those who had been chosen to search for light. The circle therefore became the first and oldest symbol containing wise and serious truths for the initiated. Probably one of the first achievements was to predict the summer and winter solstices. Undoubtedly they made those days significant and sacred. They became a priestly class. With their secret knowledge they established the earliest religious festivals, which Masons still observe as Saints John days. If this speculation is reasonable, we conclude that the circle was the first geometric figure constructed by primitive man. It was not merely a drawing, it was literally a construction, resulting from arcs eastward and westward from a central point of the observation, curved segments which resulted from joining the points which marked the sun's daily rising and setting from one solstice to another. If the central point of observation had been fixed by a pole or solid stone pillar, the shadow cast by the pillar from the hour to hour gave the primitive observers a series of straight lines by which they could construct a whole circle of dots equidistant from the central point of observation. What made the circle so sacred and mystic a symbol was the fact that it was a construction, not a mere representation of a shape, as if the fiery lord of the sky had revealed himself to the children of men and thereby unlocked other secrets for the initiated to discover and to guard. The lines which connected the stone marked points where the sun arose and set each day, as well as the lines of the shadows created by the central stela or pillar as the sun passed overhead each day, obviously created pattern of crossing lines which undoubtedly arose the curiosity of those primitive speculatives. After generations of observers had been at work, there must have come a day when one of them recognized the symmetry of the crossing lines in which created four right angles, the cross within the circle. Since that probably occurred when the night and day were practically equal, the equilateral cross also became a sacred figure, fraught with special meaning and symbolism. And from that geometric construction, another revelation from the All-Highest probably developed its use as a religious symbol, especially in festivals linked with the vernal equinox, when the dead seed was quickened into life again. But the equilateral cross, one may surmise, was the second fundamental geometric figure constructed by the primitive observers of the sun. It resulted from their representations on the Earth's surface of the lines drawn by the sun god himself as he moved from east to west, or cast a shadow from the central point of their simple solar observatories. As a figure, it probably first suggested the concept of space, especially as a direction. An equilateral cross drawn in a circle immediately suggests the directions in which natural phenomena take place, like the sun's passage across the sky, or the directions from which the four winds of heaven blow. As the simple but as yet undefined compass, it was a useful tool of knowledge, whose practical applications were veiled from the uninitiated who were given mystical and supernatural explanations of the cross's meaning. It was known all over the world, in the most primitive societies, from northern Europe to India, from China to the streaming jungle civilizations of Central America. Its frequent appearance in the religious symbolism of the Toltec and Aztec Indians of Mexico frightened the Roman priests who followed Cortes to the conquest of an area of Mexico, and one of the principal reasons why they ordered the destruction of so many of the artifacts and records of those civilizations was their fear of the pagan cross. The cross assumed a myriad of forms, many of them having a speculative or religious symbolism, from the so-called Latin cross, which is the cross on which Jesus was crucified, to the swastika, a good luck amulet, to the Lorraine cross, with a double or triple traverse, a symbol familiar to Masons of the Scottish Rite. One writer has identified 385 different crosses, but the majority of them have little interest except for those engaged in the decorative arts and the science of heraldry. Most writers on the subject agree that the equilateral cross, like the circle, the line, the crescent, and the triangle, forms so simple and natural a geometrical figure that it must have been one of the earliest geometrical constructions which primitive man had, quote-unquote, stumbled upon as a representation of the principal directions of space, the earth, the sky, the rays of light, the wind, etc. It naturally became a symbol of man with outstretched arms, of birds on the wing, of a double-headed hammer, of the bow and drill for making fire. But as part of the esoteric knowledge of the most primitive scientists, the observers of the sun, it contained more meaning than simple pictograph. It embodied concepts of radiation or space. As a symbol of the rays of the sun, it veiled knowledge of the use of these lines in solar observations. It became a symbol of the tree of life, on which depended the death and renewal of life resulting from the annual changes of the seasons. However, if primitive man by simple geometric constructions discovered the knowledge whereby he could predict the solstices by the circle of stones of his solar observations, sooner or later he must have run into the problem measuring time. An example, how to count by using units of time. The day was undoubtedly the first unit he used, since the sun automatically measured it for him, and the sun was the object of his study and veneration. A day, moreover, was a lapse of time which he could remember in his first attempts to classify and to store information for future use. But it is extremely doubtful that he originally had either the language or the mental capacity to count quantities as large as the number of days between the summer and winter solstices, even though he had arranged a stone for each day on the solar circle, which he had laid out on the ground. He had learned by generations of observations that when the rising sun touched one end of the arc, it was the first day of summer, and when it touched the other end, the sun would turn again and seek each day a more southerly point of arising. But that he had a language of numbers by which to express that extent of the passage of days, one may seriously question. We know, however, that primitive man used numbers to indicate quantities, but the records that they have left on stone suggest an ability to use only the simplest, the rudimentary numbers suggested to them by the 10 fingers on their hands and 10 toes on their feet. Among their chiseled records on stone, the numbers found most commonly are 5, represented by 5 strokes attached to a stem, the hand, and a rake-like figure consisting of a bar from which depend 7 short strokes, a representation of the number 7. Whence came that particular number, which in subsequent civilizations and religions was especially revered? Was its very antiquity one reason for its universal importance? Why are there 7 ages of man and 7 liberal arts? Why are there 7 gods of happiness in Japanese folklore? Why are there 7 sages in the folklore of ancient Greece? Why did the Sioux Indians have 7 council fires? Why did the Romans boast of the 7 hills on which their eternal city was built? Why is the number 7 so frequently used in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament? And why does the week have 7 days. The following speculation is offered with no proof whatsoever. It is sheer guesswork to suggest a possible reason why the number 7 became so important in the intellectual and cultural development of mankind. It was a quote-unquote mystic number because it was one of the earliest discoveries of the primitive scientists, the observers of the sun. It was a primordial unit to measure the passage of time which resulted from the earliest discoveries that God is always geometrizing. If the year was a concept involving numbers of days too large for the mind of primitive man to handle, he probably turned to observations of the other great luminary in nature, the moon, to observe the passage of time. We can only speculate. Could the ancient geometricians have joined the 4 points of the cross within the circle to form a square and discovered that each side of the square was related to one arm of the cross, the radius of the circle, in an approximate ratio of 7 to s? If so, they had made the first crude application of the Pythagorean formula, but at that same time discovered that the perimeter of the square measured 28 units, the duration of the lunar year in days, the square having 4 equal parts of 7 units, the phases of the moon divided in the lunar year into 4 equal parts of 7 days, or a week. By speculating on the long and agonizing process by which primitive man developed his intellect and spiritual insights, imperfect as they still are, modern Masons may increase their respect for man and his potentialities. So mote it be. Okay, next I need, as always, to mention our Android, Apple, and Windows 8 apps. It's a way to listen to the show streaming, but with some better options, and also you get access to bonus features like the papers that we read on the show via PDF and also Masonic wallpapers. In addition, sometimes we give out some great Masonic books over the holidays or short videos as well. If apps aren't your thing, we do have a donation button where you can make a donation to the show through PayPal, which is all secure, and rest assured that every dime goes right back into the show. Oh, I almost forgot that we're also on Stitcher Smart Radio as well. If you are new to Stitcher, register for free using the promo code WhenceKamey with no spaces, and they send us a dollar to help out the show. If you're not new to Stitcher, check us out on Stitcher as well. Next, I did want to share another piece called Seek and Ye Shall Find. The making of a Freemason consists of a continuing course of education, of training, and of character forming. While it may be accepted that it is an innermost desire followed by obligations that makes one a member of the craft, yet in a truer form and better sense, a man is never a Freemason until he truthfully and loyally lives up to his obligations, and he cannot do that until he understands them and eventually knows their scope and real meaning. Freemasonry can very well be divided into many phases: its landmarks, its customs, its constitutions, and its laws, just to mention a few, if studied and mastered, can provide a more interesting course for the Master Mason seeking Masonic knowledge. Its historical background can provide an interesting program of investigation to the member attracted to a desire for research. One peculiarity about Freemasonry is that it will stand investigation. The deeper the research, the more extensive the knowledge of its hidden arts and mysteries, the more highly it is appreciated. A member of the craft who merely takes his degrees in a listless, careless sort of manner, and then remains as a just spectator at lodge meetings, may hold to the opinion that Freemasonry differs little from the other societies. The contrary, the Master Mason, who delves deeply into Masonic literature, takes a lively interest in every part of the ritualistic and lodge work, and learns the origin, meaning, and moral bearings of its symbols, cannot possibly fall into such an error. To him, Freemasonry has a refining and elevating influence not to be found in any ordinary run of organizations. The philosophies of Freemasonry, when discovered, and then accepted and practiced, provide that simple but profound solution to the problems of human relationships. May it be accepted that Freemasonry is a way of living to the Master Mason who is interested enough to appraise and value the wealth that is his and his alone by virtue of his Masonic membership. The best informed Master Mason is the Master Mason who reads and studies. Consequently, if we want Freemasonry to be of practical usefulness and cultural attainment, we as Freemasons must not neglect our Masonic reading, our Masonic studying, and our research for more Masonic light. As you guys all know, I affiliated with Onnit to help raise some funds for the show. However, I didn't want to just affiliate with anyone. It had to be something awesome and good, so I picked Onnit. They make supplements for your body that literally enhance it. I'm not talking about male enhancement or anything. I'm talking about physical and mental well-being. They have their flagship product, which is Alpha Brain, which I'm sure you have all heard of. It's basically vitamins for your brain. But they make a ton of other stuff that really work well. I take Alpha Brain personally, and I find it helps with a ton of things for me. It helps with my focus, my anxiety, and just the feeling of not missing a beat. Anyway, if it sounds like something that you'd like to try, and you want to help out the show, go to our website, wcypodcast.com, and click on the links for On It. Once you're there, buy some great stuff like Alpha Brain or Hemp Force Protein or anything you want. It's all amazing stuff. If you don't like it, they'll give you your money back, and they let you keep the product. I also have a discount code for them as well if you'd like to use it, which is WCY. You put that in at checkout, it takes 10% off. Usually covers the shipping and a little bit more. Alright, next I'd like to move into this week's famous Freemason. You've heard some of my favorite famous Freemasons, and among my favorites are explorers like Shackleton and others who basically mapped the Arctic for us. Well, here's another one. Richard E. Byrd, born 1888, passed away in 1957, was a polar explorer, naval officer, pioneer aviator. Born October 25, 1888, at Winchester, Virginia, a brother of Harry F. Byrd, governor and senator. He graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1912 and advanced to lieutenant commander at retirement in 1916, and later promoted to commander after his flight over the North Pole in 1926. He was given the rank of Rear Admiral in 1930. During World War I, he entered the aviation service and commanded the U.S. Air Forces until armistice. In World War II, he served with Admiral King in Washington and Nimitz in the Pacific, going overseas four times. He was highly decorated, including the Congressional Medal of Honor in 1926 and Special Congressional Medals in 1930, 37, and 46. He made his famous flight over the North Pole on May 9, 1926 with Floyd Bennett. In 1927, he made a transatlantic flight of 4,200 miles with three companions from New York to France. His Antarctic expedition was in 1928 to 1930, and his second was in 1933 to 35. He discovered the Edsel Ford Mountains and Mary Byrd Land. He spent 5 months alone near the South Pole. In 1939, he was made commander of the U.S. Antarctic Service and again went to the South Polar region, discovering five new mountain ranges, five islands, and more than 100,000 square miles of area. In 1946, he was named commanding officer of the U.S. Navy Antarctic Expedition and again in 1956 headed the U.S. Expedition in Antarctic Exploration. He became a member of Federal Lodge No. 1, Washington, D.C. on March 19, 1921 and affiliated with Kane Lodge No. 454 in New York City, September 18, 1928. He was a member of the National Sojourner Chapter No. 3 at Washington. He and his pilot, Bernd Balchen, dropped Masonic flags on the two poles. Balchen also added his shrine fez. In the Antarctic Expedition of 1933-35, 60 of the 82 members were Freemasons, and on February 5, 1935, established First Antarctic Lodge No. 777 of New Zealand Constitution. He died on March 11th, 1957. How incredible is that? 60 of the 82 members were Freemasons. Insane. Anyway, that's it for this week. Please remember to find us on Facebook and follow on Twitter at Whence Came You. Give the show a rating on iTunes if you can. Check out our Masonic businesses, PB&J, H2O, giving you the best service and water purification hands down. Let them know that we sent you over there by using the code WCY in your notes in the purchasing. Check out Brother Harper's new book, Freemasonry in Black and White. Also, check out the interview we did with Brother Harper a few episodes back. It was great. Check out our podcast partners, Far From Centered with Brother Rob Lewis, and The Winding Stairs with Brother Juan Sepulveda. And lastly, don't forget about the Midnight Freemasons, publishing three articles a week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Always new, always good. I promise. If you'd like to contribute anything to the Midnight Freemasons, please email me at wcypodcast@gmail.com. Likewise, if you want to be a guest on the show, do the same. Stay on the level, everybody. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.